Salutations, my friends, and thank you for tuning in to a very special edition of Factions of Freedom. I am actually joined by Forbidden Knowledge. Can you believe it? We actually are joined by Billy Carson of Forbidden Knowledge. And if you guys do not know who Forbidden Knowledge is, who Billy Carson is, and what he's up to, please, please, if not before or after this episode, go educate yourself, because this is going to be one of those episodes you're going to want to replay. But with that being said, Mr. Carson, how are you?
I'm fantastic, man. Thanks for having me on. I really appreciate this opportunity.
You've been very influential. Excuse me. You've been very influential in my own awakening and some of my own research and a lot of the things that I've done. And I'm just grateful to have you on.
Oh, man. Let's go, man. I'm excited.
So I had initially hit you up to talk about the Secret Space Program, but, you know, whenever it comes to talking about all this, it's all-encompassing. So, would you like to tell the people a little bit about yourself, about Gaia, about Forbidden Knowledge, mm-hmm. about what you're up to, before we jump into
things? Yeah, sure. No problem, definitely. My name is Billy Carson, and I'm the founder of Forbidden Knowledge, which is primarily it's on Instagram. It's really, it starts with the number four, Forbidden Knowledge, instead of F-O-R. And the reason why I went with the number four is because I'm trying to let people know in an inconspicuous way that I'm coming from the fourth dimension. Kind of how I came up with the name, Forbidden Knowledge, with the number four. And I've also got a website, ForbiddenKnowledge.com, and I'm on Twitter and Tumblr and everything else. And I'm really an entrepreneur by heart, and I've been awakened for a very long time, all the way from back when I was a small kid, and had always been involved, really, in sharing and trading knowledge back and forth with specific individuals. It actually started really in the 1970s. Wow. When I started having private meetings.
Wow.
I actually witnessed a UFO in my backyard, and that really triggered me into my whole research into space and space programs and technology and ancient history and everything else. And this is all the way back, as you already know, and no cell phones, no beepers, no pages. It was all about going to the library and pulling down books, book after book, encyclopedia after encyclopedia. And I would have private meetings back then, and it kind of eventually grew to where we, into the 80s, where we would actually trade VHS tapes with information on it.
Wow.
And then cassette tapes, you know, in the late 80s, and then it changed to CDs in the early 90s, and then eventually it became DVDs. Then it got into online forums before websites, and then it got into websites and blogs, and now social media. So it's been a long time.
An evolving process is definitely what it sounds like.
Yeah, an evolving process, and over the course of this, over the years, I've read easily over 1,000 manuscripts, 1,000 books, which include different books on ancient history, ancient texts like the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita, the Vedas, Ningli, the Emerald Tablets of Thoth. You know, I can just keep going on and on. It's just lots and lots of things. But then also into the more modern time, a lot of research has been done into books like Seventh Planet Mercury Rising by Gerald Clark, all of Zachariah Sitchin's work, Holographic Universe by Michael Talbot. So I've really been able to encompass and taken a lot of information from a lot of different sources over the years, and then include that with my contacts that I've made with whistleblowers and former FBI, former CIA, and some other illicit projects that were run by the government and even DARPA. And it really allowed me to put a lot of pieces of the puzzle together. Yeah, so pretty exciting stuff.
So if you don't mind me asking, what are your thoughts basically, this might seem like a kind of advanced question, but things like the Hanebu, you know, the Nazi flying saucer, and some of the recreations,
yeah,
and things like that. We could talk about things like aliens and extraterrestrials and intraterrestrials and even, you know, inhabitants of the Hollow Earth and things along that nature.
Yeah.
But what are your thoughts about, you know, the Hanebu 2, the Nazi flying,
yeah,
saucer?
Yeah. Oh, that is definitely, absolutely 1,000% true. It's a real thing that happened in history. They actually created four of these versions of the Hanebu.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually some really old footage that's still available. I have it on my YouTube channel, which shows an actual Hanebu 1 being test flown in 1939. Okay.
Oh, wow.
Now, people have to really take a sit back and think for a second. This thing was being tested in 1939, which means it was most likely under development in the 1920s, late 1920s, to give somebody an idea of where we are and how far the governments are ahead of the the actual civilians. And I could even go further back than that to flying machines in the 1800s. But if you just stick with the Honolulu 1, which was being test flown in 1939 successfully, by the way, using a ferrofluid vortex engine, which is something that I'm researching right now with one of my corporations that I own.
Oh, wow.
And basically, yeah, what that means is they've got a rotator ring in there, which is a steel donut that's reverse polarity magnetized. It has mercury inside of it.
Yeah, I was going to say, I had heard that it was mercury that they had to figure out how to hyper-accelerate, and somehow it created its own electrogravitic force or something
exactly.
Along that.
That's exactly what they did.
That's
so
crazy.
when you put the mercury, which is a ferrofluid, it's a liquid metal, into a torus, which is basically a steel dome in the shape of a donut, and you magnetize it but reverse polarity to keep the ferrofluid from touching the inside because it can't touch. Then you accelerate that mercury up to an RPM of about 50,000, and pressurize that torus to about 250,000 pressures. Anything within a certain amount of meters of that torus is that energy field is going to become a light body or reduced gravity. Okay, so basically anti-gravity. It doesn't make you completely weightless, but it can significantly reduce the weight of anything within that bubble.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's the point. Then you only needed directional jets for changing direction, moving forward, moving backward, and things like that.
And it wouldn't have to take much force, would it?
Exactly. Oh. Exactly. That's the key. And they really back engineered this from. Now, there's two real stories about this. One is that Maria Orsic channeled it from the Aldebaran people, But I really think something, my personal opinion, might be a little something different happened. That she did channel this information for the actual floor plan and layout or the structure of how to build one of these. But I don't think it came from that far out. I really think that it may have came from these local terrestrials, underground terrestrial people. The one thing that the technology that we've caught up with today in modern times is we have the capability of putting sounds, voices, and information into people's head through satellites,
yep,
and even just through laboratory equipment.
Psychotronic warfare. Okay.
Exactly. This is proven. This is very easily proven. It's not even, so it's very easy for one of these. And the thing about these advanced beings, they like to always pretend that, that they're gods, and they always act ethereal and all these other things. I think the majority of them are just flesh and blood people with advanced technology. And I think that they somehow were implanting this information directly into her mind, but not from the Aldebaran. I think it was right local, like right here.
Through some kind of screen memory kind of technology.
Right, exactly. It's very easy to use crystal technology, Gurku technology. You can use, there's a Black Knight satellite floating right above our heads. Who knows if they have access to that, and they could have been putting that information into her brain through the Black Knight satellite. There's so many different ways that it could have been done.
So many different ways. So many different ways. Let's see. Well, sorry to interrupt you, but this
no
is
problem.
Why, at the start of the show, I told you guys, if you do not know who Billy Carson is, please definitely go check out his work. This is the type of stuff that he knows. This is why he knows this type of stuff. Hearing you basically break down like the propulsion systems of UFOs and how and the development of them and the history of them and kind of the origin, that made me think of, what are your thoughts on what's going on right now in Antarctica? It seems like we're about to have forms of soft disclosure coming, or maybe they're saying some other advanced civilization could have been there. Like, what are your thoughts on what we see with Antarctica right now?
Well, Antarctica is a hot spot, and I'll tell you straight up, because I have approval to say this directly from the man himself.
Ooh.
Major Ed Dames, who I've met in person twice. The most recent time was about 4 months ago. It was actually more than that. It was October, so about 4 months ago. I spent about 17 hours with him in Orlando, Florida. And from his mouth to my ears is that there is an above-ground base in Antarctica that is owned and run by the Anunnaki. The Anunnaki of old, still here, still traveling back and forth from an above base that all the governments of the world know about. They come and go as they please. They have crew exchanges where they change people out. They come and go. It's well known, according to him, by all the governments of the world, and nothing is done to stop or interact with them because we don't have the capability or technologically to challenge them, as well as they don't know if they can call in reinforcements and bring additional people here to cause a major war. So this is well-known information, and they're supposedly in collusion with some of the governments in terms of communication-wise. Now, what they're communicating about, he exactly did not know, but that was an exact statement directly made from him to me, which I had recorded as well on my my voice app on my phone.
Oh, wow.
But there's the reason why these countries can't just come forward and say, oh, man, there's aliens interacting with us and so forth and so on, is because the United States military, the government, really, the DARPA, the black side of it, the DARPAs, the, you know, the military-industrial complex, they have so much power within government in terms of embargoes, allies not being allies anymore with other countries. So if you're a country and you know about this and you want to come out about it, you're at risk of losing your trade with other countries. Let's say you import rice, and rice is one of the vital things you need for your country. Well, you're not going to get rice anymore. Okay. Let's say that you need to launch satellites for your country. Well, you're not going to be able to launch satellites anymore because the United States controls space.
Mm-hmm.
So these are the tools and techniques that they use to suppress information. They suppress information by threatening to withdraw your access to resources, just like they did Cuba. Okay. They suffered down there. They're still driving 1950 Chevys down there in Cuba.
Yep.
You know, all that's going to change now because they're opening it up. But, man, they've been living in the 1950s for the last, I don't know. But that's what they'll do to your country. They'll just completely freeze you in time, and there's nothing you can do. So everybody has to be in collusion with the lie.
So if I could go back real quick, you were mm-hmm. you had mentioned one of the above ground bases, and the Anunnaki, because you're definitely right talking about how America can cripple people financially, mess mm-hmm. with people's economics, you know, and do all kinds of other things to cripple people to get them into play. Unfortunately, you know, this is the American system.
Yeah.
They're in bed with everybody. They're the Babylonian system. But
yeah.
You had mentioned earlier with the Anunnaki, the above ground base, and that made me start thinking, is this the Nazi base? Is this the Nazi 211 base? Or are these some of the inner earth inhabitants that have maybe advanced technologies or something like that? Or are these two different factions? Or could you clarify that for me if you don't mind?
Well, it seems that these Nazis, when they got down there, they kind of merged in with, or they were accepted for some reason. They were really accepted by these inner earth people, which are really, to be honest with you, Anunnaki. The Anunnaki is mm-hmm. a generalized term. It doesn't mean that you're the specific ones that landed in Sumeria. It's a generalized term for beings from other planets, and really what people don't know about. That's really because you're coming from space to earth is really all it means. So you're from somewhere else.
Okay.
Now, some have really taken root here because after the last pyramid war, that Marduk was involved in Amun-Ra, some left after a nuclear blast, and some of them stayed, and a lot of them went underground. And so you really have Anunnaki living here underground right now, still to this current day, and a lot of them still have access to the base in Antarctica. And it seems like they're, for whatever reason, still directly linked to this planet. And the Nazis, for whatever reason, were given a lot of information on advanced technology and used it, and might have even traveled in this Hanabu to the moon and mm-hmm. even to Mars. It's rumored that they even traveled to Mars.
Mm-hmm.
But the Hanabu 2 was 26 meters in diameter, and they began testing that in 1942, the Hanabu 2. And that one can fly for 55 hours, you know, without even having to stop or refuel or land or anything else. So that was incredible. The 3 was just as incredible, and it was even bigger. It was 71 meters in diameter, which is now getting much bigger. And it had several test flights. They actually made 19 of the Hanabu 3s, so they had more than one of those. And that's only what we know about. They may have actually had more than those, but that was the one that was actually rumored to have gone to the moon.
Well, I know there was wasn't there like a mass UFO sighting one of the days of during the war, whenever they were trying to basically, the idea
yeah.
behind saying like the mass UFO sighting was that they were trying to evacuate all of
mm-hmm.
the essential people of the of the Reich, and whenever they actually migrated them to the Nazi base 211 over there to Antarctica, that's basically where they continued some of their operations, where they still conducted some of their experiments, advancing their technologies, and becoming part of this breakaway civilization that still did actually influence some of our own politics, unfortunately.
Absolutely. And actually, really, if you really look at it, because of the Project Paperclip and what I call the agreed ending of the war, I think I really, from researching it, it seems like it was an actual agreement. And there's a lot of evidence that points to the fact that Hitler never committed suicide, that he actually died in Orlando, Florida in 2004 in a hospital there.
Wow.
But definitely, it appears that not only did they get to the moon, but some of them have gotten to Mars and started that breakaway civilization there. And when the paperclip Nazi scientists came on board and took over leadership in NASA and other government programs, including the CIA, that they continued this breakaway civilization. And this is why, when we look at a lot of these images from NASA, from Mars, we see a lot of structures there that don't appear to be old and ancient and broken down. We see structures there that appear to be new. This is a problem.
Looks like
Why aren't these things destroyed?
It's like even whenever you look at some of the footage of some of the footage of Google Earth and what they have going on in like our oceans, you see right angles, you see straight lines, you see impressions underneath our own oceans. And then whenever you look at other planets as well, you see right angles as well, straight lines, and what looks to be evidence of some kinds of structures, some kinds of civilizations, some kind of interaction on a planet or an area that would otherwise be barren. And there's stuff like that they kind of hide, that you have to actually go out and go look at and see, well, what does this mean? Who could be actually inhabiting this area? And if anything, I think that's kind of why it brings this full back circle or back full circle to things like what's going on in Antarctica with the 70-mile crack that's occurring, some of the staircases that they're seeing, some of the other things that are popping out. And it's because of that that we're being able to get all of this disclosure, if you ask me, like I said before, this kind of soft disclosure.
I've got a couple of videos that I've done that they're on YouTube. If you Google or YouTube search Mars Moon Space Billy Carson, Mars Moon Space Billy Carson, you'll find a couple of spots that we picked in Antarctica that that show remnants of civilization there, above ground structures, and even one has an entrance, looks like a huge entrance into the Earth. Whether it's an underground base or inner Earth, we don't know, but it's definitely an opening, a huge opening. And it just appears to be a lot of activity still going there. Now, one of our researchers on our United Family of Anomaly Hunters team, named Joe White, was recently on two episodes of Ancient Aliens. The episode number 11, season 6, I believe it is Destination Mars is that episode. But anyway, he was the one who originally discovered, as an independent researcher, the gigantic pyramid in Antarctica that still has a peak on top. It still has its pyramidal structure, which is very rare to find one with the peak.
Yeah, I saw the picture. It was fascinating.
Yeah. And of course, Buzz Aldrin was just out there, and then he tweeted that we're in trouble, and this is their evil. And then they took that down real quick, and next thing you know, he came down with this sickness, and they had to evacuate him from there. So there's something really crazy going on, man.
Putin went to Antarctica. Yeah. I know the Queen went to Antarctica. The Vatican went to Antarctica. There's all kinds of stuff going on there in Antarctica. I think.
Big time.
I don't know if you've looked into the work of Steve Quayle. If you're familiar with him, but he's talking about things such as giants as well, some of the things that they're finding, not in Antarctica, but in places like Peru. And the reason why, if anything, that we're jumping around, I'm sorry that there's like not a particular line that we're following. You know, all of this stuff is definitely all-encompassing, but Steve Quayle definitely talks about, evidence of giants, ancient civilizations and things like that down there in Peru, South America, and figuring out that they too have evidence of this advanced technology. So if you don't mind me asking, what are your thoughts on that as well? Because it seems like all of this stuff that happened in our past is starting to come out to the present. And that's why I keep unfortunately, I keep saying things like, you know, soft disclosure, because I think it's upon people like yourself, you know, David Wilcock, Graham Hancock, Steve Quayle, you know, Timothy Albarino, these people that are actually going out there and then and decrypting these mysteries of our history and then trying to, you know, give it back to the public. I think it's good that we get these kinds of things kind of, you know, not in the same basket, but on, out there for people to understand. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, definitely. I mean, I actually have a skull from Peru in my house, and it's humongous. It's, you know, from an Anunnaki. It's massive. You can clearly see, even by the just the jawbone structure, how much larger it is than a human skull. Mm-hmm. And these have been found all over the place down there. So, again, more evidence, in my opinion, that these beings were flesh and blood people. They just looked a little bit different, but for the most part, they were bipedal, you know, humanoid type beings that were very, very advanced. And the reason why I say this is because we keep finding depictions, even there, of advanced structures. You know, Machu Picchu, for example, which is a place I'm going to this summer, is extremely, extremely highly advanced technology to build. I mean, you can't take an ancient society and have them build that structure on top of a mountain like that with no mortar. And then also the way that the structure is actually designed to almost, I guess what you call it when you change the shape of a mountainside, you actually, I forget what they call that, but they actually turn that mountainside at the peak into the shape of a face looking up into the sky.
Interesting.
By using whatever kind of advanced tools they could have possibly used to carve that mountain into that shape and then put those structures on top. Now, when you read the ancient text, it's rumored that Machu Picchu was actually an airport. Like, there was an exchange place where ships would land and people would get off and people would get on. And when you look at all the ancient texts, whether it's the Mahabharata, the Bhagavad Gita, the Sumerian tablets, even the Emerald Tablets, they're always landing or hanging out on top of mountains.
True.
You know, this is what they love. They love to be up there. I guess it's even if you look in the Bible, Moses had to climb the mountain to go talk to God, who was most likely an Anunnaki being. They like you to. They're always in the mountains. The Olympians were always in mountains. Mm-hmm. That's their thing. Up in the top of mountains, the Nazca lines are shaved off or cut off tops of mountains. You know, so that's their MO. And they typically use those as landing points and transfer points to move and to maneuver and get around the planet.
So would you say that we're dealing with the antediluvian society, the pre-flood society?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt about it that some of them are still here, because when you read the ancient tablets after the last pyramid war, some got the heck out of here, and some actually who were actually in love with human women, mostly, they decided to stay. And I believe that they're not only still here, some of them are still alive, but I believe that their bloodline are the quote-unquote custodians on this planet.
I'm definitely glad you said that, because in one of my recent videos that I did, I'm not sure if you've noticed some of the things that we're talking about, chimeras, transhumanism, just all this genetic modification and stuff that we're doing. One of my mindsets, and Tom Horn talks about this as well, the idea that they're going to try to bring back extinct beasts using things like gametogenesis, and then, you know, a woolly mammoth and elephant type of situation, or a chicken and the egg type of situation. One of the ideas with that is basically being able to resurrect some of these long forgotten creatures, i.e. chimeras, manticores, and then obviously subsequently giants, Anunnakis, pharaohs, and whoever else's DNA that we do have available.
Right.
One of the things that you keep referring to is pyramid wars. Now, could you explain that to me, and if anything, see if there's any kind of correlation between the two, between us basically trying to bring back giants, bring back all these these ancient creatures, and at the same time, if you could try to explain what these pyramid wars were.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, first I'll start with the first question about the genetic manipulation of and trying to revive cloned creatures from the past. A lot of people don't realize what happened with these with the Egyptians and the Peruvians and the American Indians even and the ancient Chinese in Asia. They found mummies on every single continent on this mm-hmm. planet. Mummies. Now, these mummies typically have the organs removed. This is part of the mummification process, okay? But then they're buried with gold and this and that and all this other stuff. And you know, so when they come back, they can have everything they need. Or when they get to the rumor is when they get to their next life, they'll have everything. Now, obviously, these people are not stupid. They know that they're not going to leave this dimension from death and wake up and have all their gold trinkets when they get to the next dimension. Right. So I think that's been a incorrectly stated idea or misconcepted theory. I think what basically, from my research, has happened is these ancient people were taught by the Anunnaki or either tried to mimic the Anunnaki from a rejuvenation chamber or a time capsule that they would go into, or maybe to actually just the main objective was to preserve their DNA. So that when the Anunnaki mm-hmm. probably promised them that we'll come back in the future, we're going to take your DNA as long as it's in good enough condition, and we're going to clone you and bring you back. This is why you need all your wealth and riches mm-hmm. here. So when you wake up from the cloning chamber, here's your access to all your gold and your riches and everything else. It's like you never left. You see, so I don't think that it's so much for that they're going to be going to another dream world or another heaven or another whatever. I think it's because they thought they were really going to be coming back to this same exact world and this same planet with all their gold trinkets and all their wealth and their riches right here where it's still located.
I agree.
Yeah, and that's what I believe happened. Now, with the Pyramid Wars, what people don't realize is when they read the Bible is the Bible is not talking about the God as most people know and love. I hate to break it down to them like that, but it's really just a hardcore fact. The Bible, the word God in the Bible is actually mistranslated into a singular term, and it's actually God's plural. And you can only get this when you go into a more ancient text and discover that you're reading a really manipulated text when you read the modern day Bible. Mm-hmm. You can get a little bit closer to the truth by going to the Ethiopian Bible, because they've included about another 60 books that the regular modern day Bible doesn't have. They kept the Book of Enoch. Mm-hmm. They kept a lot of the other apocrypha texts in there, which are the Lost Book of Judah. They got all those books in there, and they've kept a lot of the original terminology almost exactly the way that it should be when it's translated. Including Elohim is noted in there as being a plural term, not a singular term. Whereas in the modern day Bible, they have it set up as a singular term to make you think that it's a god, and all the separate gods, Yahweh and Elohim, which are multiple gods, and Jehovah. These are all individual people, multiples of people who are actually Anunnaki relatives of each other. This is the biggest thing. So when you finally analyze and break down the biblical text and really look at the ancient Sumerian text and then start to realize that the Bible, especially in the book of Deuteronomy, is really talking about wars between the Anunnaki relatives. They're fighting each other, and they're using human beings as their cattle to get to go out and enter another family member's kingdom, kill all the women. The book of Deuteronomy says literally, kill the women, kill the children, kill the animals, kill the babies. If you find a woman that you think is a virgin, take her as your wife. It's okay to rape her. This is actually in the Bible. This is actually, and most Christians have no idea because they've never read the Bible. Mm-hmm. They literally, what they do is they go to church, unfortunately, and then they just listen to what they say. But if you take the Bible,
and they analyze that particular scene, though, in the Bible, they actually understand that it's telling them, kill these people of a different race.
Yes.
Exterminate the entire different race, because these people, they are not human. They are not, you can't get rid of them, because if a single one of them comes back, then that is how they procreate again. That's how they mess with the genetics again. And people don't understand that fact. But please continue.
Yeah, that's, you hit it on the head. And then so what will happen is they'll go do that. And then another one from another part of the world will say, okay, now I'm going to send you guys over here to kill them. And it was just a battle going back and forth. And eventually it even got to the point where there weren't even enough humans to battle each other anymore, because we were wiping each other out. So then they started using the weapons of old, which were basically, from all the descriptions, appear to be nuclear type weapons, because they had where you when the bomb would drop, it would have a mushroom cloud as described in the text, People would completely turn to ash. If you were further away and you would get the what they call the evil wind, then you would get sick, your hair would fall out, your nails would fall off. This is all like, radiation sickness. And this happened. Now, when I went to Egypt in 2014, and I went to the Great Pyramids, the sand right outside there on the ground, right in front of the pyramids, you could put your hand in it and run your hand through the sand, and when you scoop your hand up, in most cases you'll have the little pieces of glass in your hand. Now, this glass is from an extremely, extremely hot event that happened a long time ago. And this is why they take those little pieces of glass and they make jewelry out of them. It was actually, my archaeologist told me it was in remembrance of the ancient war. Okay, so even they know that there was an ancient war there, and this war, whatever it was, wherever it generated this level of heat to turn sand into glass, that's vitrification, it had to be over 3,000 degrees. So this is really an amazing artifact that's left behind from an ancient war, proving the ancient text that there was definitely a war. The archaeologist says there was an ancient war, and all the people who make the jewelry from these pieces of glass that are remnants of it in remembrance of the war of the gods right there in Egypt. So it's a true fact. It's a real thing that really happened, and it's well documented in ancient text.
Well, that's what I think a lot of people, with the whole thing with Antarctica, I think a lot of people are starting to understand that our history is definitely a lot more advanced than we give it the credit for. You look at things like Tesla, the research that Nikola Tesla did, and how mind-blowing it is and how beneficial it could be towards society. But what did we do? We went towards finance or finite resources and development of that. Whenever we look at our history, we can see evidence of so much advance. It's like when you look at things like Teotihuacan, as you said, Pumapunku, all kinds of other places like that. Not only do they have a geological or a physical structure that is awe-inspiring, but it also has like a spiritual implication for these types of things. And I think that's very strange because we understand ourselves deeper and in that aspect, you see. So it's like whenever I don't know, whenever you see these types of pyramid wars, whenever you see the evidence of a global civilization, of us actually interacting prior to what I would consider this global flood, it gets kind of crazy because you can't deny what you're actually seeing. You're seeing your history take place not only real time, but lifetime as we rediscover it.
Absolutely. And I think that people need to understand that they should not feel like, if you're a spiritual person, it should increase, let me change it around. If you're a spiritual person, it should increase your spirituality. What happened for me, I'll just give you my personal experience. When I began to get the complete realization of what's really going on out there and how big everything really is, I didn't feel smaller. I felt part of a bigger thing. I felt like not only that we aren't alone, but there's a whole a mega world, a mega universe going on right around us, right above our heads. People living, dying, eating, taking their kids to games, whatever. This all this stuff is going on. The same things we're doing here, there's people doing it all over the universe. And the history, the true history of mankind is so colorful and so huge. It just makes me feel like I'm part of a much bigger thing. I don't feel small. I don't feel tiny. I think that if you think that the humans are the only beings that exist in this gigantic universe on this one planet that can only sustain life, I think that makes you feel very, I mean, I would feel tiny. I would feel like this is nothing. But now I feel bigger because I feel like I'm connected to something much more grand. And that's how I think people need to take a look at it.
Was we start to understand like deeper truths about our history, like the universe. The universe of ourselves, understanding the universe versus the universe, as above, so below, as within, so without. We are a representation of the universe experiencing itself. And I think a lot of people are starting to understand, the truth of that and what that truly does mean, how beautiful one individual can be, how much they're able to do. And I think if anything, that's a good way to branch into on your page, you talk a lot about the holographic universe, and that's definitely for me coming into this because it's very strange. But when you talk about some of the things in the holographic universe, it blows my mind because it's very simple, but at the same time, it's a very deep spiritual truth. Would you mind sharing some of your thoughts on that?
Sure, absolutely. I think that when I tell people that we are living in a holographic universe, the first thing that they think about is some type of a video game, or which is actually correct, but they think of it as like it's a toy, or it's fake. How can it be? Because if I saw a hologram, I could put my hand right through it. But what I think they have to understand is that we are living actually in a fully immersed holographic universe, which means a couple things. The first thing it means is that there's a creator. So if you believe there's a creator, guess what? You were right. Okay, number one, because there's a creator or creators. Okay, you got to keep that in mind as well, of this holographic realm that we're living in. And why is it holographic? Well, if you look at a hologram, holograms are made of fractals. Okay, so anything in the smallest can be found in the largest. It's the same exact way in this universe, in this realm. We are living in a fractal holographic universe. Scientists have already figured out, by going down to the very smallest particle and looking at it from that level and bringing it all the way back up to a full scale, how we are actually living in something that's a mirror of itself. And in other words, the human eye, you can see that in a nebula. Okay, when a star explodes, you can see cell division. So it's that as above, so below thing. But from another point of view, Sylvester James S. Gates of the University of Maryland, who is he's one of the world leaders in supersymmetry and quantum theory, he discovered through his studies and research that there's a code to the ether of the universe, the actual ether, the soup that we're actually moving around in, and we think it's just free-flowing air and vacuum. It's actually a soup. And he discovered that this soup runs and operates on a code. And the thing that's crazy about it, he discovered that this code is the same exact code that drives your browser on your search engine for your computer.
Interesting.
So this was mind-blowing. It blew the physics community away. They all got on board and researched it, and they discovered that it's actually true. Now, here's what's really crazy about it. The thing that he discovered in these codes are called adinkras, A-D-I-N-K-R-A. Adinkras. Well, adinkras are actually neurological symbols from the Dogon tribe. They've been passing these adinkras down and talking about holographic universe for thousands and thousands of years. Okay? And matter of fact, you can even buy adinkra clothing from certain sites online which have these adinkras on them, or from the Dogon tribe in Africa. Wow. And out of Mali, Africa, this Dogon tribe, they knew about Sirius B, which is a star that's actually run out of fuel. They knew about Sirius A, which is its binary twin. They knew about the Nomo that came here and gave them this information about the universe, the secrets of physics, the planets in our solar system, the shapes, sizes, the colors of our planets. They knew the color of Uranus. That's all they knew. They know the color of Neptune. They have all this information in their history, in their knowledge and wisdom. And amazingly, they have the adinkras, which was now more recently discovered by, or I should say rediscovered by, Sylvester James S. Gates at the University of Maryland. So this takes it to a whole nother level. It really adds some solidity to the fact of the holographic universe. Now, what does it really mean to be holographic? It doesn't mean that your feelings are fake. It doesn't mean that you're fake. It doesn't mean that you're not experiencing life as a conscious being in this realm. But what it does mean is that a couple things. The first thing that it means is distance is an illusion. Mm-hmm. That's number one. Everything appears to be separate and apart, but in true reality, that's a complete illusion. And one of the people that I posted on my page really said it the best. What is true reality outside of your brain, outside of your skull, basically? It's like you have five friends. You're inside of a dark room that you can't see anything with the door closed. And you have five friends that go out to the outside of that room. They go out. One is sight. One is smell. One is touch. One is hearing. You know, these are the name of your friends. They go out and they gather all this information, but they don't themselves understand or know what they're gathering. They're just gathering information that they can't even decipher themselves. But then they bring the information back to you in the dark room and give it to you. And then you, in that dark room, which is your brain, figure out or decipher this information and then create an image of what you see, smell, hear, touch, feel that's out there. Okay? So you are literally creating a hologram with your own mind. That's even more evidence of the holographic nature of this universe. It's really, everything out here is really nothing but electromagnetic waves. And matter is the illusion of solidity, because matter is actually only electromagnetic waves slowed down to a slightly slower frequency to give you the illusion of solidity. But the only thing that keeps your hand from passing through a wall is the fact that the electromagnetic frequency in your fingers is different from the electromagnetic frequency of the atoms on the wall. You actually really never touch anything. There's no such thing as touch. You never touch anything. The only thing you do is you repel, your frequencies repel on contact. So you never really touch anything. You only have the capability of letting molecular repel molecular. So this is kind of what it really means. And in a video game, you never see the next frame until you need to get to that next frame of the game. So if you're going through the maze or whatever, or you're fighting things on the screen, and then you make it to the next level, you can't see the next level while you're in one screen. You've got to continue to progress through the screen. And so what that really means is, and from a consciousness standpoint, is collectively we're creating a collective. The collective consciousness is creating everything we know, what we think is out there. So and what happens is, based on the double-slit experiment, you know, it's saying that things only appear when the conscious observer look at them. Mm-hmm. Until that point, everything is just a frequency or a wave. So this is really amazing stuff.
Wasn't there Dr. Masaru Emoto, didn't he have a experiment similar to that, kind of like the double-slit experiment, where it wasn't so much an observer style, but he kind of put off impressions on a different types of water, different types of ice, where he tried to put off different feels, different vibes, different emotions, different thoughts, and he actually observed some of the changes in it. It was gradual over time, but there was actual scientific documentation of changes taking place, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. I'm luckily, I was fortunate enough to meet him before he died at the Conscious Life Expo. That was in, I think that was in 2012, might have been, in Los Angeles. He took droplets of water from the same source, put them in jars, and then he literally showed the power of conscious thought by writing on little pieces of paper, "I love you, I hate you, I wish you would die, you're amazing." One had a prayer that was, water that was prayed over. Mm-hmm. So all these different various types of conscious thoughts or feelings. And then when he went and took that, put under a microscope, droplets of those different jars of water under a microscope, you can see that the ones that were "I love you" or "prayed over," "you make me happy," those droplets looked like perfect crystals underneath the microscope. But the ones that that had "I hate you," "I wish you would die," and those types of things, they looked like malformed. Even some looked like they were polluted from polluted water, and they were from the same clear stream. It's just amazing the power of. And the human body is water, made of about 70-80% water. So what he was trying to say was the power of conscious thought itself out here in this thing. You're able to manipulate this programming that we're operating in. Your avatar can actually engage and interact with the programming of the ether. And it has an effect, or direct effect, on human bodies as well. So that's why you have to think before you tell somebody something that's evil and disgusting and horrible, because you really have the power over them when you say those things, because once they hear that, it goes into their body and affects them on a molecular level.
In a rough way, in a weird way, I think what we're trying to say to the listeners and to the people that are paying attention right now is the fact that this universe that we live in, this strange world, this reality that we have, it's not. I'm not trying to say it's malleable. I'm not trying to say, you can build your life like Legos, but I'm not necessarily saying you can't. I'm saying with the time that you have here, you're definitely able to use your willpower, to use your mindset to actually build something forward. Now, if you don't mind me asking, with that, the understanding of the holographic universe and experiments like the double-slit experiment and Dr. Masaru Emoto's experiment and things like that, what do you think, if you don't mind me asking, what's your opinion on what all these pyramids around the world, what could they have been? Why do we see so many cultures that have so many different pyramids around the world, even in Mexico to Africa to Asia, even Antarctica that we're discovering now? You know, as we said before, is this more evidence of the antediluvian pre-flood civilization, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, the pyramids are evidence of a lot more. They're evidence of the Atlantean civilization that's definitely antediluvian. It's they go way, way back. The Great Pyramids themselves, like the Great Pyramid at Giza, I should say, and the pyramid complex there is much, much older than even some of the truth seekers believe. You know, they're still talking about 12,000, 13,000 years. It's more like 60,000 to 70,000 years in that range. The pyramid complexes that are found all over the world, and I've been fortunate enough to go to some of them. I've been to Giza. I've climbed inside the Great Pyramid. I've been to the Yucatan Peninsula, to Chichen Itza. I've climbed that pyramid. I've been to Teotihuacan in Mexico City, in that range area, in that area. I've climbed the Pyramid of the Moon and the Pyramid of the Sun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's an amazing experience. Amazing, amazing experience. So, but what you discover is that these pyramids are all multifunctional computer systems. And when you really begin to dig into the measurements of the pyramids, you begin to realize that, for example, the Great Pyramid at Giza, for one, I made a post today, it actually calculates the distance from the Earth to the Sun. It calculates the distance from the Earth to the Moon. And it also calculates the speed of the Earth orbiting. I think I made that yesterday, I think it was. The speed of the Earth orbiting the Sun.
I think it's good before, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I'll let you go after. I think it's good that people understand that what we're talking about, because he's saying that the pyramids are different types of technologies. What we think of as technology and what we are sitting around in as technology are two totally different things. I'll say this, and then I'll let you have it one more time. I remember listening to Graham Hancock talk about how some of the experiences that people were having with ayahuasca and clockwork elves and things like that, they described plants and the ayahuasca brew and some of the leaves and all the what we would consider biological animal life or plant life. They considered that technology. They were saying, oh, it is so wonderful that you discovered this technology. And this is after having a liquid, a brew, something that he created from leaves and water. And now if they're able to consider some kind of potion, a form of technology, then pyramids, as we see them now, as I said before at the start of the show, having a spiritual implication to these types of things, that's the kind of technology in which we're trying to explain. There's a spiritual component to some of these technologies that we are still trying to understand.
Absolutely. You're 100% right. You hit it on the head. I give you a quick example before I go back into the pyramids. In the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, he talks, there's this one scene in the first tablet, actually, where he was took off from Undal, which is another land somewhere else, and his dad told him to, or his ruler or his king, but it really was his dad, told him to go follow the planet he knew and go basically bring up the, go contact the hairy barbarians in Kem and bring them to a higher level of civilization. So he gets into his ship and he takes off. And how do you know he takes off? Because he said they rose into the morning sun. They didn't get on a boat and sail out. They rose. Huh. Then as they came across the land of Kem, this is in the first tablet, they descended on the land of Kem and the hairy barbarians. This is in the tablets. And then they opened the door to their ship, and as they came out, him and his crew, it says that the barbarians came at them with clubs and cudgels, seeking to utterly harm the sons of Atlantis. And then what he does is he raises his staff and sends out a ray of vibration, stopping them still as stone in the mountain. So he has first two pieces of evidence. One is that they're in a ship or a vehicle that flies. The second is he raises the staff and sends out a stun vibration that actually stuns them and freezes them. The next thing that happens is he says, I begin to show them my magical science, and they groveled at my feet. So they thought he was a god, and he had to tell them, look, we're just advanced beings, and we're gonna talk peace, and we're gonna teach you how to do some of this stuff. But the magic science that he talks about several times in there is different ways that they know how to create things using a combination of what we call unified physics, spirituality combined with physics.
Mm-hmm.
Because he talks about using frequencies and sound to create matter into existence and these types of things. To us, that would be magic, but to them, it's technology. You see, so you're absolutely right on that point. So the pyramids, the Great Pyramid of Giza, is a gigantic computer. It's almost as if Thoth, who actually says he built the Great Pyramid in the Emerald Tablets, not this Cheops guy that they, you know, who stole the idea and everything else. It was already in existence. Slaves and all these ramps, that's baloney, okay? You would have to have more mass than the pyramid and ramps just to get the stones.
Right?
It's not going to happen, okay? He not only did he build a Great Pyramid, but according to Herodotus, he built the pyramid from the top down. But when he built the Great Pyramid, it's like he took a computer program. They had these things called the Tablets of Destinies back then. Maybe he used that. I'm not sure. But he took something and he gathered all the content and information. Almost be like how we could download the entire Library of Congress. He downloaded some massive core of knowledge about space, the solar system, the ether, everything. And he said, okay, now I'm going to import this into this construction project. And then we're going to build this pyramid. And when he built the Great Pyramid, it served so many purposes. First of all, it's an actual archetype of the planet itself, because the pyramid, the height of the Great Pyramid, is the exact height of the average height of landmass on the planet. So if you took all the landmass around the entire planet Earth and averaged, gave it the average height using, you know, a calculator, you'll discover that the height of the Great Pyramid is the average height of landmass on Earth.
Oh, wow.
You can only do that if you have something that scans the planet, okay? That's number one. Number two, the Great Pyramid, when you look at the way that it's sitting on top of a reservoir, well, it's now a dry reservoir, but there's a huge reservoir, or was a reservoir of water underneath the Great Pyramid, which was fed in from the Nile. And now it's dry because while I was there, even the architect, the archaeologist, I'm sorry, it was talking about how kids would go down there and run into those old dry, you know, tunnels, tubes down there, which used to be full of water. But anyway, the reason why you want to build a pyramid on top of water, and most of them are, is because you create something called physiostatic electricity through the granite, crystal granite that pyramids are made of, and then the water being actually the atoms or the ions, I'm sorry, being pulled up into that bottom chamber.
Interesting.
Then from there it goes into another chamber, which in the Great Pyramid was called the Queen's Chamber. Now, there was a device in there that's been removed. We don't know exactly what that device was, but whatever that device did, going up the Grand Gallery, there are these slots going all the way up that, according to a lot of researchers, used to hold something called like resonance bars or resonating stabilizers. If you want to call it that. They're these things that would fit in the slots and actually would somehow sonically resonate this sound frequency and step up the charge as it moved up into the King's Chamber.
Oh, wow.
And then in the King's Chamber, there's more, again, more evidence of technology that was there but now is removed in the thing that they call the sarcophagus, which is actually never a sarcophagus, first of all, because none of these people were that small. It's if you take the exact size and dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant, mm-hmm. it can fit directly inside that box that's inside the King's Chamber. And I was in the King's Chamber. I was stood right next to it. Go ahead.
I was going to say, all of the descriptions that they have as far as the Ark of the Covenant is that it does display some of the same characteristics of something that might be holding nuclear material, an explosive electric charge, or something where it kind of has, I don't want to say destructive capabilities or destructive powers, but it's obviously a huge power source. And any time you hear about the Ark of the Covenant in any mythos in the Bible or any other texts, it's always it's always exuding immense power that people have got to figure out how to stabilize. So that.
Okay, great. Well, let's talk about the Ark of the Covenant for a minute. When I went into the Great Pyramid, I stood next to the what they call the stone sarcophagus on the inside of the King's Chamber. And this stone sarcophagus is actually not a real sarcophagus for a human being to go in, because I've been all over Egypt. I've been to all the tombs and the Valley of the Kings. When you go into these tombs, the sarcophaguses are super massive. You don't even know how they got them in there. They weigh tons. Well, this particular stone sarcophagus that they're trying to claim was for a pharaoh is for it would be for a child, if anything. The actual dimensions of this, what they're calling a sarcophagus, is actually the same exact dimensions of the Ark of the Covenant, which is in the Bible and several other ancient texts.
Oh, wow.
So, yeah, if you were to take this device, and I call it a device because it's definitely some form of technology when you read about what it had the capability of doing. But if you take this device and put it inside that stone box, it would fit perfectly. And it actually gives the finishing touches to what that Great Pyramid would need for a power generating source or amplification of the power generating source coming from the ions that are coming up from the base of the pyramid. The pyramid itself is basically built on top of a reservoir, and that reservoir creates physiostatic electricity, and everything is drawn up into that king's chamber. The thing that sends it out into the actual stratosphere or ionosphere is which is missing, is the pyramidion or the capstone, which was most likely made of solid gold, which would then transmit that wireless power out into the ionosphere, and then it would be captured by the obelisks. The obelisks would then act like those giant granite obelisks would act like jumping stations to jump the wireless power around the area throughout the region, and then they would capture that electricity on these thing called Jed pillars. And Jed pillars are in the hieroglyphs all over Egypt. They're seen as technological devices that kind of really resemble the Tesla coil, and or the Tesla coil resembles resembles those, and they have wires coming out of them that then connect to different types of devices like sewing looms. They connect to light bulbs. They connect to devices that look like they're electro gold plating devices to do a lot of the electro gold plating that you find in Egypt from ancient times.
Like the Baghdad battery?
Like the Baghdad battery, correct. Now, the Baghdad battery would allow you to do electroplating, but what these Jed pillars are actually shown sometimes connected to devices that appear to be devices that they're using to do this electroplating. So, you know, they had the Baghdad battery, which is just solid copper core inside of a vase with fermented fruit juices. Mm-hmm. To create electricity. So they actually knew about electricity. And then, but they also had these Jed pillars from more ancient times, which were way more sophisticated than the Baghdad battery. And when you look into the story of Moses and the Hebrews leaving Egypt, you start to realize when you really dig deep into it, that there may have been another reason for the Pharaoh to change his mind and have the army chase down Moses, which may have actually been the Pharaoh Akhenaten, who was married to Nefertiti, and who was actually the father of King Tut. But what it appears to be is that they took this Ark of the Covenant out of that stone box inside the Great Pyramid, because that was the power source, and they wandered in the desert with this power source. According to the Bible, this power source is what they used basically for almost everything. They carried this thing throughout the desert for 40 years. It was their source of energy. It battled enemies for them. It did all these things for them. And it had to be carried a certain way. You had to wear these type of special garments with a breastplate on. So if you touched it the wrong way, you would be electrocuted. If you came around it without protection, without these special garments, your nails would fall out, your hair would fall, you'd get sick, you'd get blisters. It almost sounds like radiation poisoning.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it lets you know that this was definitely a form of technology, and it seems as if the Pharaoh chased them down because he realized they had stolen or taken the Ark, which was their source of power, and Egypt would be cast back into darkness without it. So it's an amazing device.
I don't mean to interrupt, but it seems like we're talking... This physiostatic energy that you talk about, that blows my mind. I think it's such a crazy concept, but it makes so much sense. These Jed pillars, this physiostatic electricity and energy that's all around, it seems like what they're doing is trying to harness, if anything, the natural ambient energy of the planet Would that be right? And then trying to basically channel it to other devices, or what would we consider, as we said before at the start of the show, different types of technology? Is that about right? Right?
Oh, that's accurate. Totally accurate. That's exactly what they were doing. They were really masters of doing these of tapping into the ambient energy, the zero point energy, even using sound frequency energies, to actually levitate stone. Which in some of the text, in the Emerald Tablets of Thoth, he talks about using frequencies to not only levitate and lift, but also to jingle, for lack of a better word, matter into existence.
So if you could, could you? I don't know. Is there a way that you could explain a little bit better zero point energy for the people? Because I think that would help them understand. The idea of being able to construct some of these massive monoliths, some of these obelisks, and some of these this anomalous architecture that's in our history.
Sure, no problem. Well, basically, zero point energy is what it's saying is that you're able to capture electromagnetic waves directly out of the atmosphere. So we're living in this soup that we call an atmosphere. It's really a liquid. It's almost like a liquid. It's like a flowing liquid that we're living in. Even though you really can't feel it pressing against you, there is an appreciable value of force that this ether that we're living in surrounding us is actually pushing on our bodies. Mm-hmm. And a couple of scientists have already discovered ways of putting together equipment that actually measures that force and is actually even able to convert that into electricity. Now, one way that you can do it, there's a company that actually has created one. It's called a Bloombox. Now, a gentleman that I forget his name exactly by this second, but the gentleman that was responsible for this invention was hired by NASA. He was actually a NASA vendor to create a little box that they can put on Mars that will convert carbon monoxide into oxygen. So that was the original purpose of this device. Yeah. Now, through an accident, and they reversed the chemical process inside this box. And this box is only about 10 inches by 10 inches squared. Okay. And that by reversing the process of the chemical process on the inside of the box, they discovered that it would absorb the electromagnetic air out of the atmosphere, and it would actually mix it with sand on the inside. There was this particular fuel was just basic, really sand, silicate. And then from there, it would convert it into electricity. And they discovered it put out so much power that one small box can power a small house. Amazing stuff.
You know what's weird is, like, I was talking to somebody the other day about Organite. Have you heard of Organite?
Oh yeah, I have some Organite. Yeah, I have Organite. I have Organite pyramids at my house.
So is it kind of like the same? Is it kind of like the same concept where they're basically just using the natural elements of the earth to redirect to harness the energy of the planet?
Yeah, like the Organite absorbs the energy and sucks it right in, and then focuses it. And like mine focuses it through my apex of my pyramid because I have a copper coil at the top of those little pyramids, okay? And it's supposed to be the negative energy and puts out the positive energy. But this is a very similar device in that these little sheets that are in there have this composite painted on them, which is top secret. But whatever this composite is, it actually absorbs. Now, electromagnetic radiation is every single, you can't even get away from it. There are basically everything that we actually even, that we see with our own eyes, that we perceive that we see, is actually an electromagnetic frequency.
I agree.
It's just slowed down, to turn into what we conceive as matter. But there's really nothing out there. Everything is a wave. So what this thing is able to do is able to collect the waves that haven't been what we perceive to be solid. It takes that energy and then it converts it into power that can be used. So that's one way of getting zero point energy. There's another way of doing it as well. Another way would be to use magnets. Okay. Mm-hmm. Now magnets make it very easy. I actually created a very small one at my house. If you took a fan from your computer, a computer fan, and then you went and put a magnet on each blade, glued it to the blade with super glue. And then you take four much larger magnets and put them on each corner of that computer fan and then start the spinning, reverse the poles of the ones that are on the outside. It's going to continue to spin. It won't stop. Now, if you take a coil of electricity, electric coil, put that in the center of the fan, and then take two wires out, positive, negative, and connect it to a battery charger, connect it to your cell phone, connect it to a light bulb, you're going to find that it's going to turn on. The light bulb will turn on, your battery will charge up. You just took you took magnets and converted the repulsion of the magnetic force that created movement and converted that movement into electricity. And this can be stepped up into a very big generator. You can actually create a generator that once it started, it would never stop. It would run for eternity as long as the ball bearings or whatever, you know, don't wear out.
Where it stays in equilibrium. Stop it.
Correct. Exactly. And that's free energy. You can, everybody can have two giant magnets at their house in their garage generating electricity for free right now. No need for a power station.
So what do you think about Tesla trying to, if anything, you know, hijack Tesla's original ideas for their technology and basically trying to sell free energy to people? I mean, if you ask me, right there, you kind of basically solve somewhat of the energy crisis, or at least
kick some of the ideas out there. Oh, there's so many ways to do the free energy. It's just that, like, for example, the Bloomberg box that I try to get my hands on, because I actually have a big project in Georgia. It's called Fort Terra Nova. The History Channel featured me on this. If you Google Billy Carson History Channel, you can even watch a couple of the episodes. I partnered with Walton McCarthy out of Texas, and we formed a corporation called Fort Terra Nova, and it's an underground city that holds 360 people in case of a disaster.
Oh, wow.
Now, it's real. Now, down there, we use turbine diesel engine generators, which run on, obviously, fuel. And but I wanted to get the Bloom box because I found out, man, if I can get this box, then I don't have to worry about space for storing fuel, and I can save more people. I could put more people down there in case of a disaster, because the fuel takes up a lot of space to have 1 year worth of fuel.
Yeah.
So I contacted them, and they finally got back to me after me bugging the crap out of them, and they told me that the U.S. military had bought up all the contracts and that they were only allowed to give it out to a couple more major corporations, and that was the end of it.
I'm sure.
And I was like, oh,
I'm
my.
Sure. Of course.
Jeez.
Of course it would.
Yeah.
And you didn't tell them that it was for the bunker, that it was, like, you know, going to be actually used for something beneficial? It wasn't just going to be kept away?
Yep, I did that, but there's nothing they can do. Their hands were tied. They had already signed off on it. I'm pretty sure they were probably forced into it, or who knows, but I don't know how much money they may have taken or whatever, but it's over. It's a wrap. So I was like, wow. So that Google has one at their university. It powers the university. And there's a couple other Fortune 500 companies that have it. And outside of that, it's military. So that's the end of that. And you can see a real good demonstration of it if you go to YouTube and just Google the Bloom Box. There's quite a few videos on even the inventors there talking about his contract with NASA and everything else. So
you said that this Fort Terra Nova was a separate project that you're working on with people in Georgia. If you don't mind me asking, you've talked about the Anomaly Hunters team. Could you talk about that as well? Because I mean, you're up to all kinds of different things.
Lots of things. The reason that I decided to build this structure in Northwest Georgia was because of the anomalies that I was actually discovering. Basically, how I got into it was I'm an amateur astronomer, so I was researching the precession of the equinoxes and really trying to get deep into pulling down some quality images from space and tracking the stars. And I always thought in my mind I might be able to find an anomaly in space, like another planet or another asteroid or comet that nobody's discovered. So I was looking hard. And what I discovered, though, through my research and through all this astronomy, was that the precession was actually speeding up. Now, the precession of the equinoxes is the location of the stars and the zodiacs in the sky based on the wobble of the Earth at the time. And it takes, based on our wobble, it takes 27,000 years for it to make a complete wobble. So the stars that you see in the sky, or that you see in the sky at night, it takes 27,000 years for them to come back to the starting point again. So when I found that it was speeding up, and I was like, well, why would precession speed up? What would cause the Earth's wobble isn't speeding up? I verified that. So what would cause the precession to speed up? And the only thing the conclusion that I can come up with was that the Earth orbits the Sun, so the Sun must be speeding. You know, the Sun is actually orbiting the galaxy, so the Sun must be speeding up. So I started looking into that, and I discovered that the sun is speeding up. Well, what's causing the sun to speed up? Well, the only thing that can cause the sun to speed up is that it has to orbit something. So the sun is, or you know, the Earth is orbiting the sun. The sun is orbiting the galaxy, but the sun at the same time is also orbiting another star. So we live in a binary solar system. So through this method, I discovered that we do live in a binary solar system, and through that, I started finding out about the Sumerians text talking about a rogue planet that orbits another star, which is most likely a brown dwarf star, and that's the red sun that you see on top of a lot of these ancient Egyptian statuettes and stuff, and carved into the glyphs. It's not our star that's on top of their head. It's actually their brown dwarf, and their planet orbits this brown dwarf star, and their planet's called Nibiru.
I was just about to say, it sounds like you're describing Nibiru or Planet X.
Yes, exactly. Which NASA has openly admitted in 2016 that they discovered it, but instead of calling it Planet X, which would be 10, they call it Planet 9. But regardless, they found it, and it's about 4 to 6 times larger than Jupiter, and it's actually a brown dwarf. So this big time astronomer comes on Fox News, and he outwardly and openly states that we live in a binary solar system with two suns. I'll send you the link to that so you can have it on your you can add
That's
it to
wild.
this blog. Okay,
That's
openly
wild.
says it on national on TV. Just hey, yeah, we have two suns. We have a solar system within a solar system,
That's
and
wild.
this is wild stuff. Nobody know. They're not teaching this in school, even though all the top astrophysicists know this as a fact. They're still not being taught in schools.
So if you don't mind me asking, could I get your, have you heard of the Schumann resonance, the basically like the heartbeat of the planet?
Absolutely.
Do you think that has to play part in any of this as well, or if Nibiru has to affect the Schumann resonance as well?
Well, anytime you have an additional gravitational effect put into play, you're going to have an effect on the Schumann resonance. You know, and how I know a lot about this is because I'm actually a composer, and I have two songs out. One song is called 528 DNA, which is actually already on iTunes and everything else. The song is built on the frequency of 528 hertz. And I have another one which is built close to the Schumann frequency, which is called 432, Look Within. And that one is on CD, baby, but it's coming out to iTunes and everything else probably within a couple of days. It's already been submitted. And that song is based on the Schumann frequency. So I know a lot about, I put that up to say, I know a lot about the frequency and how it affects the human body. Now, what happens is when you have another spatial body with the type of mass as a brown dwarf star, and the brown dwarf is much smaller than our sun, but it has almost the same amount of mass. Now that mass creates a what they call a gravity well, and that gravity well turns into a wave. Now this wave is washing across all the planets in our solar system and all the moons in our solar system, just like waves wash across the shore, you know, at a beach. Okay, wash across. You have rocks on the beach, and the waves come in. Now what happens with these waves is these waves are energy waves. Okay, these gravitational waves. Gravity is also energy. This is what people have to understand. So as these waves come in and they interact with these planetary bodies and these spatial bodies, the energy goes in and the energy must come out. This is what's actually the true meaning, the true reason why we have global warming. The global warming is not coming from car emissions and cows passing gas and all this kind of stuff. Does it have a little bit of an effect? Yes. But the true reason why, if you go into the astrological data right now, you'll find that every single planet and moon in our solar system is experiencing global warming at the same time. Did our exhaust fumes leave Earth and go to Mars and go to Pluto? No. Okay. Matter of fact, there was a scientific study that came out in 2015 that said Jupiter's core is melting. And they said if it was Earth, we'd be already extinct. All the ice caps have melted on Mars. Mars is full of liquid flowing water right now. This is on NASA.gov. Pluto is experiencing global warming. What's happening here? What's happening is these gravitational waves are entering, and where are the waves coming from? They're coming from what NASA is calling Planet 9. We call it Planet X if you're a truth seeker. And what it is people get confused with Nibiru and is it a Nibiru is a planet that orbits a brown dwarf star. So it's its own little solar system. So Planet X is really is actually really a star, not a planet. But it has little planets that orbit it. And Nibiru is a planet that's about 4 times the size of Earth, and this brown dwarf star is about 4 to 6 times larger than Jupiter. So that's what you have. We have a solar system within a solar system, and then so the anomalies. So that triggered me to go to look into more about the space. So I started logging into the NASA image files, where they had this thing called worldwidetelescope.org. So I go in there and I start looking at stars, and then I notice that you can go look at planets. And so I go, wow, I can look at planets. So I pull up. The first one I go to was Mars. So as soon as I got to Mars, I log in. It looks like you're going right through the rover camera, and I pull up this image called the Opportunity rover image called the it was the Opportunity of Voyager. Opportunity image, yeah, it was an opportunity image called McMurdo Valley. And as soon as I opened it up, I saw anomalies. I saw out-of-place things. I saw rocks that didn't look like rocks. They looked like structures. And I'm going, what is this? This is weird. Now, the word anomalies and all, I wasn't even thinking about that stuff. I was just curious to see what was up there. Right. And then all of a sudden, all this crazy stuff started popping out at me. And that's how I got into the anomaly hunting. And then through that, I started finding other people that were already doing it. And we formed this group called the United Family of Anomaly Hunters. And now it's 14 of us all together, 14 groups that have combined to form this nonprofit organization. And we've pulled down over 1 million images from NASA, from European Space Agency, and from the Indian Space Agency. And we've found about 50 to 60,000 anomalies now. And it's incredible.
I think one of the stranger things are talking to you about with these anomalies that you're seeing, like on the moon and on Mars, is I think I remember you telling me how you had a telescope that was able to see subsurface structures. Am I remembering that right? Or
Well, that's actually not my telescope. I wish I had that telescope. That's the government's telescope, but we have public access to. They sent radar images. They scanned it with radar images. What they do is they basically bounce. They use a satellite in space right above Earth in low Earth orbit, and they use the Arecibo ground radio telescope in Puerto Rico, which is super, super massive. I mean, that thing is like the size of a small city. That's how big that dish is. It's humongous. So they then send these radar waves to the moon, and then they grab it back at Arecibo, and then they process it into image data, and then they put it on their website, and anybody can access these images. Well, when you look at it, you start to see that there's subsurface structures on the moon. I mean, they're there. There's no denying it. There's no, oh, I wonder if this is that. I wonder if it's that. No, there's subsurface structures that are plain as day, easy to see. They're on the moon. And, you know, like I was telling you before, Apollo 11, I have the entire black box, which I sent you the link to. You can leave it here for your listeners. The Apollo 11 black box, it records everything. Even when the astronaut sneezes, it's on there. Now, they tried to black out some of the stuff. A lot of this came from the Freedom of Information Act. So some of the content on there was still blacked out. But some of the stuff they left in there, and it makes you go, why would they leave this in there? But it's there. For example, when they're flying over one particular location on the moon, they're saying, look at the convex craters down there. Now, you know, there's no such thing as a convex crater. So they're trying to say dome structures. Mm-hmm. And they go, and the other astronaut goes, wow, the people down there, I bet they never get out. You know, this is on the recording and as well as in the printed black box tape, which I sent you. So that's just one of many things they said.
Before we jump into that, because I definitely want to follow through on that, I wanted to get your thoughts on what you thought about them trying to create this temple on the moon. Apparently they're trying to create like some kind of lunar temple. Apparently, I'm not sure what the purpose of it is, but they're trying to create some 3D printed lunar temple on the moon. Where I'm like I said, I'm not entirely sure on the purpose yet. But what do you think of? What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that's their way of trying to, if any way, lead credence to the moon being inhabited, or to establish some kind of connection between us and the moon? Or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's very interesting what they're doing. I mean, even when they landed on the moon, they timed it to where Orion was directly at 33rd degree angle to the moon landing location, and they landed on the 33rd degree parallel and all this other. So they do a lot of ritualistic stuff at NASA. Mm-hmm. Now, the interesting thing is when they orbited the moon, they were saying that when they got towards the backside of the moon, they were even saying that you can hear on the black box, do you hear that? Do you hear that? They were hearing something like choruses playing and people humming and singing on the dark side of the moon.
That's strange.
That was bizarre, and it bugged them out. It literally bugged the astronauts out.
That's wild.
Yeah, I know. And it was so loud that it was coming. And how did it get into the capsule? Who knows? Maybe it's coming into a radio frequency or whatever it was. But it was definitely there and they recorded it. Okay. So it makes you really quite a question. I really do believe that they went to the moon on a mission to give obviously the people a fake story what's up there, which is just dirt and which is what they want everybody to believe. But the truth about it is that there are people there, there's inhabitants there, and I believe that they made contact and communication with these people, and maybe even worked out some type of a treaty or agreement. And maybe even there might even be a trade agreement. We don't know. I mean, we have military shuttles launching all the time. Even though the space shuttle program has been quote unquote shut down, there's military space shuttles that launch all the time. And one went away for 425 days before it came back. Where was that thing gone for over a year?
It was
You know?
docked. I bet you it was docked somewhere.
And it could have been docked. It definitely, it wasn't on the ISS, so it could have been gone to another space station. It could have done sent. It could have sent supplies to Mars. It could have went to the moon. Who knows? We'll never know, because that's top secret information. But when these things go up and go, they're not just going to go to orbit. You can put a satellite in space to orbit and take data. You don't need a space shuttle for that. You know, so a space shuttle is a lot more expensive to launch.
So what would you say to the idea that we're already colonizing space, or that we're trying to colonize, I guess, other planets at least? Because it seems like that's obviously that's where we're trying to go. People are trying to do the breakaway civilization type of thing. We already talked about the colonization of the moon, the Nazi 211 base in Antarctica, and things like this. Would you say that we are colonizing space? Because it seems like already with the Star Wars bill too, the new bill that was introduced underneath Obama, we're already weaponizing space. So would it be too far-fetched to say that we're colonizing space, or at least trying to colonize our atmosphere, our magnetosphere, or the moon, or anything like that?
I believe that we're already colonizing other planets and moons in this solar system currently. There's a couple of moons out there that I believe the Anunnaki are, there's some stayed on Earth after the last Pyramid War, but some left. Now, they it appears that this region of space has been abandoned after that war, but in true reality, what we're calling what we think is a long period of time is a very short period of time to them. So if something doesn't happen to over here for a couple thousand years, we're like, oh, it's been forever since anything's ever happened. It's a window of opportunity that I think the governments know about, and they're taking advantage of, and colonizing the Mars, and other moons in our solar system like Ganymede. I believe there's, I believe they sent the mission to Ceres, which is another small planet right beyond Mars. Which very few people even know exists. It has more fresh water on Ceres than on the Earth. So people don't even know that this planet is in our solar system. It's a very small planet, but as soon as they got there, the lights were already on. Then they started trying to make all these excuses. Oh, we think it might just be ice. Ice doesn't shine in the darkness, buddy. It's people, the lights are on, man. They're over there. They're living over there right now. But there's definitely, without a doubt, one of the images that I found in McMurdo Valley on Mars. It shows clearly a military base with a swept wing plane, a helicopter type device, or there's shadows underneath these that match the shadows. So you know that they're above the ground. And then what appeared to be a tank on the ground, and maybe even a cannon. That actually made the news, and it also made Deep Space on TV, a series hosted by Gaia TV. They had all their analytics, their video and photo guys analyze it before they put it out to make sure it was vetted. And they were like, this stuff is in the image, and they put it out. So I think that we've already been working on that. There's something back in the 60s, I believe it was, called Alternative 3, where they had three things that they were going to consider. One was to send a bomb up into space and blow out, try to blow out the magnetosphere, try to blow out the, I'm not, the try to blow out the not magnetosphere, the Van Allen radiation belts. They did that, didn't work. They added more radiation to the belt. The second thing that they were going to do was build underground bases. They've already built over 1,600 worldwide underground bases. I know that for a fact because I started getting involved in it when I started Fort Terra Nova. And then the next thing that they were going to do was start a breakaway civilization, and the first location was to be Mars. And fortunately, since I've been involved in this, I've met important people in that area, important ex-CIA agents, important ex-FBI, and also Laura Eisenhower, who's the granddaughter of the former president Dwight D. Eisenhower.
Oh, wow.
And matter of fact, she was with me at the last Mars conference in 2016, where she spoke and I also spoke as well. So she's going to speak at the next one here coming up in May of 2017. And I got to have dinner with her, sit down with her and talk. And I knew she had been recruited to go to Mars several times. I had only heard about it on radio and other interviews by George Newry of Coast to Coast AM and stuff like that. But this time I got to see her face to face, you know, and talk to her directly and be there. And I'm telling you, it's an amazing story. They really aggressively wanted her to go to Mars in 2006.
That makes me start thinking, well, what's going on Mars? Why are they trying to pull off so many influential people? I mean, obviously it's the breakaway civilization, you know, the secret society, but it's like, what for me on the outside looking in, what does that mean, you know, for the larger goal?
Well, I think that they know there's a pending, this is again why I started Fort Chernova, because as I started finding out more about Nibiru, then I started learning about, not that Nibiru is going to hit the Earth, but that, and it's still very far out. People think it's going to show up in 20. It's not even close to coming to Earth or getting this region of space. But what happens is it dislodges comets and material inside of the Oort cloud, which is beyond Pluto, and then those little bodies of, you know, dust and rock, which are actually gigantic, you know, somewhere the size of states, they start streaming inward towards the inner planets. Now, we've had several close misses within the last couple of years. One actually got through and blew up in Russia a couple of years ago. And we've had some that the size of states scrape our atmosphere on the way by. More recently, even just a few weeks ago, it happened again. One came in between Earth and the Moon. They're all coming from the same direction. They're all coming from the location of Planet 9. This is why NASA has spent billions of dollars building the WISE telescope, the IRAS, which is now offline, they say, but it's still online, I believe. But all these infrared telescopes to find this. They build infrared telescopes to find this brown dwarf star because you can only see it in infrared mode because it's a low-emitting heat star. So these comets are all coming from this direction, and that's the big problem. The problem is the debris that is dislodging from the Oort cloud sending to the inner planets. So I believe that they already know that there's a possibility that there may be an impact, which is why Obama ordered this mission to go to a comet and try to work on seeing how if you could push it in different directions. This is a multi, you know, trillion dollar thing they got going on. And I think that they're trying to find a way to do that. But in the meantime, there's a breakaway civilization just in case they can't figure it out.
There's so much more. I wanted to get your opinion on one more topic. I don't know if you have time to answer it, but it's alien abduction, the hybridization program, and if you see that kind of having any weird similarities to the transhuman agenda. I'm not sure if you can correlate the two, but I just wanted to, if anything, get your opinion on the alien abduction phenomenon, and if, you know, what you think that is, even though we're talking about this breakaway civilization, the idea that we have been interacting with these entities for quite some time, just what your thoughts are on that matter.
Well, I believe that the alien abduction is 100% accurate and real and true. And anybody who says that they don't believe it, I think is a smack in the face to the millions and millions of people that have been victims of it. I came out with my situation. I was never abducted by an alien, but I had an interaction with two gray aliens, which I came out on in 2016 in an interview that I had with Thomas Mickey Schroeder Jensen of Mars Moonspace. First time I really publicly talked about it, and I actually put that snippet as a little cut on my first album that I did with Donnie Arcade. It's like an interlude area where I talk about what happened. They came into my house, and this is during the time that I was starting that Fort Chernova project, and they didn't take me. They didn't communicate with me telepathically as far as words that I can understand, but whatever they were doing was making my head shake and hurt, and I don't know if they was putting information in or taking information out. I really couldn't tell you. It was horrifying, and I tried to scream, and I couldn't get any words out. And people were home at the time with me, but nobody was. I was in the family room, which is in the center of the house, and the house is a split, gigantic split floor pan, and nobody could hear me anyway. And then within several minutes, they left. Two small gray aliens, about maybe no more than 4 feet high, because I was sitting in a chair, and they were my eye level. And it was horrifying. Now, people who, after that, I knew for a fact I could never doubt it again. But people who say they've been abducted and taken, I believe them 100%. And I believe that something that John Lear said, where he said that they're almost grown like plants, and they're a lot of the grays are actually created. Mm-hmm. They're cybernetic organisms that have long since outlived their predecessors or creators. And one of the things that a lot of people feel, even not just him, but some other people that I've talked to now, is that they're trying to use genetic material from humans to create hybrids so that they can eventually create a hybrid that can actually obtain a level of consciousness that can allow it to survive after death.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, reach higher realms of, higher dimensions.
They're trying to calculate the soul, so to speak.
Right, exactly. That's what it seems like. And it's happened to millions of people, and unfortunately, it appears that, according even to Laura Eisenhower herself, out of her own mouth, was that her great grandfather Dwight D. Eisenhower made a treaty with these gray aliens,
mm-hmm.
in return for technology. And sounds like my phone's ringing. Oh, hold on. Let me hang this up. I'm sorry.
You're fine. If you have to go, that's good. Entirely understandable.
No, I'm good. I'm good. Don't worry. Yeah. So he made a treaty with these gray aliens, in regards to accepting technology, in exchange for they were only supposed to abduct a very small amount of people, mm-hmm. and obviously that's not what happened. So there was another offer by another group of entities to just teach us how to live better, free energy, extended life, and that was denied. So we took the one for the war, and we ended up getting duped, is basically what happened.
Yep.
So that, that's where it's at. That's as much as I know.
I definitely agree. The 1954 Grayada Treaty that was signed underneath Dwight D. Eisenhower, where they basically said, for X amount of people, we'll mm-hmm. give you this kind of technology. Obviously, the deal went sour, as you said before. They definitely started taking more than their share, and mm-hmm. we did have other entities come in. This is what's considered the Space Brothers, the Anunnaki even, Pleiadians, mm-hmm. all these other races came in and tried to actually offer us some assistance to people, but it becomes this huge philosophical, metaphysical understanding of, at this point in time, because we've made certain decisions and we've gone with this technology, we now mm-hmm. have to pull ourselves out of this situation that our forefathers have put us in. And
yep.
it sounds strange, but that's where we're at these days. There's so much more I want to ask you, but I definitely know you have to go.
Yeah, I just got to get down here. I'm at the expo right now. I'm going to go downstairs and go to this next meeting. But man, it was great. We got to get on again and do this one more time.
I'm just glad that you were able to come on and talk to the people, because like I said, this is the reason why I wanted to have you on, just to tell people, to tell people that the amount of information that you put out, the amount of work that you do, and how it's spot on. I just people really needed to hear that. That's all I got. And I'm just grateful that you're on.
Hey, man, thanks for having me. I appreciate it. And whoever wants to see some episodes of free episodes of Deep Space with me, featuring me, I'm in 6 of the episodes. They can go to Gaia.com/forbidden with the number 4, or they can go to forbiddenknowledge.com. And right there, there's a link to actually pull down some of the episodes and watch them, and also some free episodes of Cosmic Disclosure as well.
Awesome. That is awesome. I mean, closing thoughts, other than, I know you got to get to the expo, but closing thoughts, anything else you want to let the people know?
I just want to say, everybody's, stay woke. I mean, it's a slang term, but stay woke is so real. You really have to start digging and diving into this information on your own, not just relying on myself and others to give it to you all the time. It's really good if you can take notes, go and then go to NASA.gov, go to ESA.int, go to all these sites and try to pull down the information yourself. Try to duplicate some of the things that we've done and find some of the things that we've done, so you can feel better, because it's almost like a salesman who's trying to sell something, but he didn't really believe in it. So sometimes it's harder to do it that way. But when you believe in something, when you see it with your own eyes and you go, man, this stuff is really here, this is really going on, it's a lot easier to relay it to other people, I think. So I really implore everybody to start doing their own research and digging into this information themselves and taking a chunk out of it and trying to see how much they can digest and then regurgitate it out to other people the best way you can.
I definitely agree. And we try to do it every week. I would, I would want to say, like I said, thank you for coming on, Mr. Carson, and I cannot wait to have you back on or to hear what you're up to next.
All right, man. Thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you, and I'll talk to you real soon. Good luck at the expo.
All right, thanks. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that is why we have on Forbidden Knowledge. This is why we have on Billy Carson of Forbidden Knowledge. I hope you guys found it as enlightening, as insightful, and as thought-provoking as I did. Truly. Truly. And this is like I said, this is why we have him on. As you can tell, he's a very busy man, and having to get him to sit down to talk about these types of things, you know, it's busy. So definitely go look into his Fort Terra Nova project, look into his 528 DNA song, as well as his 432 Look Within song. With the Anomaly Hunters, you know, the United Family of Anomaly Hunters, come on. Like, this man is busy. Definitely go check out his work. Go to his website. Check out his page on Gaia. Go to ForbiddenKnowledge.com. See all the things that he has to offer, because I swear you will not be displeased. But like I said, I'll try to put some of the information that he said throughout the episode in the description bar so you guys can benefit from it. And we'll talk real soon. But that's all I really got for you guys. If you have any questions, feel free to email me. I'll have it in the description bar below. And as always, guys, stay vigilant. Expose lies and share truth. This is Noisera, Freedom Faction, out.